Is everybody with me? Okay. That's what I say to my students. Is everybody with me? As anyone who ever read her essay, Death by Poetry, knows, Catherine Rankovic's long-awaited first book of poems, Fierce Consent, almost drove her mad. But at long last, here we have it. Her fierce humor, her fierce sadness, fierce upbringing, fierce sexual politics, and the fierce eye which she casts both on herself and her own writing. As poet and one-time St. Louisan Meg Shirky writes, Catherine Rankovic achieves an astonishing range of tones in Fierce Consent and creates in the title series a heroine who fiercely consents to life by recognizing and celebrating its maddening combination of obstacles and pleasures. In addition to her madness and shocking contrasts and juxtapositions and her distinctive humor and hardships, we love Catherine's writing for its fierce honesty. She is, perhaps, one of the most honest writers I can think of. I've known a lot of writers, but she's probably the most honest writer I can think of. Catherine Rankovic was born and grew up in Racine, Wisconsin. She has worked as a journalist, an editor, an office clerk, and in the printing industry. She holds an MA degree from Syracuse and an MFA degree in poetry from Washington University. A teacher of creative writing at Washington University since 1989, she has taught at the St. Louis Writers Workshop, the University of Missouri St. Louis Graduate Creative Writing Program, and the Washington University Summer Writers Institute. She has published essays in the Missouri Review, the Iowa Review, the Progressive, Natural Bridge, Del Mar, St. Louis Magazine, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the Riverfront Times, where she was a contributing writer for 5 years, and also in the anthology Memories and Memoirs, Mid-American Press, 2000. Her poems have appeared in Boulevard, River Styx, Sou'wester, 13th Moon, and many other journals. In addition to Fierce Consent and other poems, she contributed essays to the hugely popular anthology Guilty Pleasures, Indulgences, Addictions, and Obsessions. Please welcome back to the River Styx podium, Catherine Rankovic.
Thank you. And happy first day of spring. Yeah. I'll read mostly new poems tonight, but I'd like to start with one from the book. This is the first poem in the book, and I think what this poem is about is very young, knowing that I would give my life over to books and reading. A Library Stairwell, 1962. Was it there, card in hand, I was made solitary? Or solitary, not to be reclaimed, did I come that first day, descending as directed the composition stairs? The handrail, like a long thought, to deliver me there safely. Within a year, the stairwell would be repainted crimson and a mobile hung to desolidify the tall air. But that first day, I'd expected a dungeon. I wasn't disappointed in the gouged walls painted dark, glossy green, bare bulbs exposing tonsures of numerals like rudiments of brain. Like one who can't No, she's entered her final home, the refuge that will sustain and then swallow her. I had no fear of entering the door with its picked at golden numbering 01. It was there, card in hand. It was then. I have some new poems for you, and well, I'll just get into them. They're mostly self-portraits. This one's called Self-Portrait with Hand-Painted Sweatshirt. In glitter paint, Tucson, and a fabric paint saguaro on a teal blue sweatshirt. Thanks, Mom. I level with the ironing board I watched her 40 years ago, sprinkling cottons and rolling them in towels like secrets, so the iron would steamroll any snow-colored creases, because someone would be looking and judging. Who? Then double knit and wash and wear, made waste of the head scarf and cotton house dress. Now women wear sweatshirts and sweatpants when they reach a certain age, and I have reached it. Half cotton and half polyester, shark hide-like, hard to wrinkle. The women and their shirts are insufficiently assertive without large photo transfers of a grandchild or glass gemstones fastened with a trademark tool, bedazzler, or kittens and birdhouses fabric painted onto them, or sequins spelling Nana, or sexy senior citizen, or gingham hearts applied, or prettied with their own decorations and designs. Once in the Oklahoma panhandle, in a camp clubhouse, I saw women's sweatshirts for sale. One white with a botched, hand-painted, smirking daffodil. One yellow with a tomahawk applique set off with orange rickrack. Tagged $30, they hung unattended, souvenirs of local culture. So hideous, I said, no one would even steal them. Yet this was someone's art, some lady's self-expression. Yes, someone like me from the world of rubber bathing caps, topped with trembling rubber flowers, or fringed like shredded coconut. Or someone from the foundation garment era. Moms, cut loose into leisure now, riding her Toyota into a cowgirl's retirement. The true paradise the movie Sunsets hinted at, in the world Dale Evans and Loretta Young ruled, that made a bestseller of Gift from the Sea among women working Iowa soybean fields. Still going for shampoos and baby doll pin curls on matronly bodies minus a breast. They dress now as athletes dress, not as ladies who slept with their husbands before anyone else. Now they and their deep-fried tag-along men are magnetized to bus trips to Las Vegas to play nickel slots with abandon, confess to having hated parenthood and snow, and loving grandchildren, gambling, crafts, and exercise. Live and kicking, they dress in gym socks and athletic shoes, as did no aging women before them, and in sweatsuits, turquoise, pink, and iced grape. You can see them filling seats in the super auditoria at Branson, or in a supper club dancing in their Walmart fanny packs and sneaker feet. Oh, you like that, hey? I wrote that at the Writers' Colony at Ragdale, which is in Lake Forest, Illinois. If you have a chance, most of you are writers, sign up and go for a Writers' Colony retreat. I was there for 2 weeks. It was great. They feed you and house you, and all you do is shut the door and write. And you can come out and make friends and stuff if you want, but you don't have to. It was wonderful. That one's called Ragdale. There's like 70 of them in the U.S. Sign up and go. I find that poets are frequently obsessed or interested in the period surrounding their births or just before. And for me, that would be the Cold War period and the earlier days of television. And of course, I write about that. I wrote this one about Captain Kangaroo. Most of you know who he is. I won't go into it. His show ran for 29 years. The fact is, as a journalist, I met him 3 times. Met Bob Keeshan, who played Captain Kangaroo. I have no memory whatsoever of what we talked about, and there's no record whatsoever. But this is my self-portrait with Captain Kangaroo. met 3 times, but the memories are void. I wanted to tell him how his entertainments terrified. The clock with open eyes and the dancing bear's nose, half as wide as its face. Like someone's brother I knew, born without one. And the question marks appearing at a distance, then approaching inhumane. A bassoon in the background, the most frightening laryngeal voice of all the instruments. And cartoons that were only squiggles and lines, something about them. What do they call those things, those bombs that leave nothing but buildings behind? So post-war, amputee, modular, low budget, and colorless Mr. Green Jeans with his rodents smiled and came and went like water in a gutter. And the captain, who said he took off his socks and then his shoes to go wading in his plastic pool, and I waited to watch him do that because it was a trick I couldn't get my mind around. And how hand puppets took over the program, Bunny Rabbit with the glasses whomping the captain with a carrot, and sock-faced, soft-antlered Mr. Moose, Bullwinkle but impotent. And nothing scares me more to this day than the skeletal antics of marionettes and Raggedy Ann with black stitches in her face. And the whole thing set to music, cardboard stars rocking to a recording of High Hopes played as unremittingly as ultraviolet exposure. There was something so abstract about it, so Martian, in how it arrived through airwaves and antennae and wouldn't add up to a story or an equation, squares and triangles without context, and something about, oh, magnets or electromagnets, and turkey-shaped stencils spiked to a wall and wiggled to fiddles, and magicians spinning plates on sticks, and Mr. Moose with his chin on the captain's bar as if suffering from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. In the middle of that bizarre little house that disappeared like occupied Japan. God bless Bob Keeshan and his show. Self-portrait with pinched nerve. My face stricken and arranged like a crossword puzzle. Gangland-style execution, every answer. And crazed with pain, every clue. Head sunk to the occiput on a spine brittle and cracking like dry bamboo, except it stung. I walked around with a purse weighing 13 pounds plus a 20-pound tote with the collected essays of George Orwell, and notebooks and a laptop and 2 frozen meals and 2 pairs of spectacles and memory disks and stuff I had to mail and a deck of tarot cards and Alastair Cook's America and the Reader's Digest Treasury of Wit and Humor over my right shoulder that I compensated for by leaning left. I wanted to be like the best people and never complain, but dissolved beneath my white-lipped fortitude like a sunken tablet of Alka-Seltzer, saying, ow, and maybe it's a tumor, and this must be what the old folks talked about while I was treating the world as my nightclub. And son of a bitch, it feels like someone substituted throwing stars for my vertebrae. And on advice from the internet, I emptied from that 13-pound purse a kit for self aspiring to be better, rather like a condominium self in a better neighborhood of self that I could rent by the minute. Aspirin, notebooks, combs, brushes, breath mints, ibuprofen, sleeping pills, bupropion, day planner, spare keys, a wallet, pens, a handkerchief, 3 lipsticks, cellular phone, Huck Finn, bottled spring water, hand mirror, and magnifying glass. And cards I can't leave at home without being sued or alienated. Health care, ID, ATM, AAA. And my business cards that make me want terribly to do better because they read so much like an obituary. And I realized it's the angel on my shoulder who packed 33 pounds to get herself through one day. And the devil on the other who let me carry it and lied to me, you can do this forever. It's much better now, thank you. I have a wonderful dentist. He's just so great, and I almost enjoy going to him. He's a very serious, solemn kind of guy and a perfectionist, which is the kind of guy exactly you want working on your teeth. But I did notice one time that this seemed to take kind of a toll on him. And so this is self-portrait with dentist. Over that sleepy leather lounge chair, oral cavity lit as for glamour photography. After completion of my cleaning, hovers my dentist. Nose and mouth diapered. Looks fine. Okay. Twirling his index fingers, he demonstrates again proper flossing technique. And he is so handsome. Trim, clean shaven, clean cut, odorless, tactful, and manicured. So obviously gay, but so serious about his work. I want to giggle, but I don't when the floss gets stuck. What do they call our pairing after 11 years? Doctor and patient? Partners in oral hygiene? He's going gray. While except for the gold crown he crafted for tooth number 30, painlessly, so good I show it off, I haven't changed. But once I did embarrass him, mentioning an item he'd not taken care of. And faintly he'd said, "Forgive me." His blue eyes stung by a perfectionist's tears. And I hated knowing exactly what they were and where they came from. It's unusual that I moved to write a poem about a painting, but in this case, I wrote about Lautrec's Clownus, which he painted 8 times. And the pictures and the sketches and paintings show a kind of well over middle age, flabby looking woman dressed in a leotards and like a clown costume top and a little white wig that's peaked at the top. And she went by the stage name of Cha Ukao, which translates out to Miss Can-Can Chaos. Okay, this is when the Can-Can was very hot in Paris. Lautrec admitted to having obsessions with some of the entertainers which he drew and painted, and she was one of them. And I wondered why, and I've always liked the idea of just of a clowness, a female clown. I think that's a cool word and a whole cool concept. So this is about Lautrec's Clowness. 8 times he painted Cha Ukao, the clowness, but not performing, only dressing or at rest. One view shows her fastening her black satin bodice, exposing a breast. Lautrec called that picture Clown with Tits and put it first in his book of prostitute lithographs. She, Miss Can-Can Chaos, dancer, singer, equestrian, and gymnast, rowdiest in France. For 7 years had a side job, posing for an artist, obsessed with her flab and ironic inner sadness. Wearing black satin bloomers, that mocked those of loose women, double-chinned, doe-faced, above an acid yellow ruff, exposing décolleté she could not afford not to show because it's humorous. She sits idly, legs splayed on a red banquette, or she's not far from the bar at the Moulin Rouge, 50, ignored, her hands in her pockets, every patron's back to her, her top knot announcing who she is. A character, but is she still funny? Can she, who can't earn any glances, earn tips? One pencil sketch admits she still had presence, riding into the Nouveau Cirque ring on a donkey on Mardi Gras, 1896, surrounded by honor guards with bayonets. Lautrec sold the illustration to a magazine. When its background, a patron in the gallery, attends only to the way his waiter pours his wine. It is Lautrec's final image of the clowness. In this picture, trim, perhaps he did not go on to sketch her as she was, because he had already painted her future. The clowness he elegized as a has-been in her 50s, in a photograph taken only 7 years before, was not yet more than 25. At the peak of her career, he painted chaos with folded hands, never making any noise, never as a poster, but as a working madam, a miscalculated man, goat white from nightlife and a ruin. Because he painted her fading and tired, or once astride a jackass, how great she must have been. Okay, it's self-indulgence time. I wonder if you're like me and you like to look up famous people who were born on your birthday. Have you ever done that? Found out the luminaries born on your birthday? Well, my birthday is January 23rd, and I have written a poem about some of the celebs who were born on mine. I'd be surprised if you'd heard of all of them. But born on January 23rd, indispensable but minor luminaries, Humphrey Bogart, Django Reinhardt, Ernie Kovacs, Princess Caroline of Monaco, all on the strangest trips and trajectories, all short-lived or long beset, all great in their recorded moments, all good at choosing spouses, all with the oddest smiles. Bogart, afraid to show his bridge. Kovacs, a villainous underwater grin, I froze at that frame of film to study it. Caroline, a licorice brunette, her husband killed at 30, expertly delivering a smile like Grace's. And Chita Rivera shares my birthday. Not the star, but the spitfire, the comic relief. And Jean Moreau, more actress than beauty, and a Nobel-winning physicist and professor of chemiluminescence, whose magic is incomprehensible to me. They sidle through their days, minor geniuses, surely, even Stendhal, whose The Red and the Black I read in translation, trying to read myself through the birthdays of the well-known. I don't smile, although my teeth are superb. I love cameras and recording equipment. I love the ghosts that haunt film. I love the glitter Caroline leaves behind when she disappears into the Pyrenees with pastels of children, making a triumph of a crippling event, as did Django Reinhardt. Oh, and then John Hancock, who I guess did only that one famous thing. And Edouard Manet, whose paintings are one vowel away from being greater art. Okay. Some older things from the sequence Fierce Consent, which is like a chain of 53 poems, which together comprise kind of an autobiography, but not really, because not everything in it happened or is true or whatever. But I heard some ladies over there, they want to hear some sex. So you're going to get it. The sonnets in the sequence are called by numbers, and this one's 25. Don't impregnate me. I've got things to do, places to be, and I haven't read Brecht yet. Sure, I like you. Although the sex is crude, it's sincere. And your hair is lovely, smells like spring water vapor, is fun to run fingers through. And I've greatly enjoyed your company, and I'll continue to if there's another condom in your wallet or at the all-night store. Otherwise, no. Sorry if you think me rude, but I've places to be and things to read and do, and I've got a great lawyer. Okay. Sue, this is Sue Saba's favorite 45, and I'm reading it just for her. 45. Am I here to decorate your penis, or am I something larger? Good Lord, what a possibility. What you think I am, I can't even see, except in a well-placed hand mirror. Walking down the street, I feel like a rebus. Men shout out the parts as they figure them quickly. Skill like that must take a lot of practice. By the end of the block, I'm a symbol, as blank between breasts and crotch as a succubus. Carla Cormier and I once waited on the corner for a taxi, unaware we were insatiable. 6 cars pulled up for us to get in. How much? You ladies having a 2-for-1 sale? Okay, for anybody who's ever had a bad marriage or bad relationship or went through a bad time in their relationship, this is a pair 20 and 21. What man wants a wife who wears constantly black and has thousands of lesbian friends? Wouldn't you worry a little as she takes apart heterosex like a mental mechanic? Says, men are expendable. After watching you air guitar to Jimi Hendrix, which is your perfect right, you bringing home the larger check, and this being a free nation. Free to be an idiot, aesthete, she says, throwing an anthology of 17 male poets, all scared of women, across the room. Huh? Wouldn't you mentally scratch your head? Where is that sexy girl in the teddy who tells you now that she only married so she could refuse to perform in bed? They were the kind of couple devoted to the zen of acrimony. She finding his cufflinks sickening, and he in her hip fat finding blinding Satori. Their wedding picture looked on, Neanderthal with naivete, while they fought about one another snoring and played the audio tapes each made independently, each wearing the other down to a primate, sentient of only hate. They knew only what they intimately hated, hated what they intimately knew. And if they'd had any shame, should have liked professional demolishers curtain their window. Okay, for my last trick. This is the last poem in the book. It's called Vox Humana. I've been to many concerts, and this has probably happened to you too, where You're enjoying the music, and the guy next to you has fallen asleep and is snoring, and everyone in the whole place is like appalled, and they're going, kick him, do something, and you never know what to do because, you know, whatever. And so this is about that, Vox Humana, subtitled at a concert by the Budapest Chamber Orchestra. Bartok doesn't engage him. He's snoring through the molto adagio of the divertimento. This morning, I poked a sleeping poet in the rib cage to halt the epic he was writing through his nose. My father snored, monstrous garlic heads of sound. My in-laws in tandem, the sound of sawing wood. Their son snored also, the snore of a saint, by day forced to sell a $600 vacuum. Whence this music, pipe organ, cello played with its cover on, songs without words of desire. For what? Air, caviar, or fame, these arias with high notes and gaps between phrases timed for maximum suspense. The work of a lost, extraordinary artist, of whom all interpretations are ingeniously correct. Before, because of whispers, I poke him to sentience, the ancient to my right, who wouldn't stay home and brood about dying, who purchased the seat that's always next to mine, supplies the undersong of Budapest at night, clerks snoring through Bartok, sleeping through Liszt. Thank you. Your great audience come out tonight.